We're talking with Dave Politis about new cases, urban cases, outlined in his book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence. Dave, tell us, before we get into specifics of the cases, what are the highlights to look for? What are the characteristics that tie all these together? Some of them are similar to the rural disappearances, right?
Oh, absolutely. First, there's a lot of very, very smart students and college-aged men that were athletes that disappeared. And as you go through the book, I think it's pretty easy to get you tend to get into this mode where everyone, just like you said, is the same thing. But as being a police officer and for 20 years and working in that urban setting, what do you see in the middle of the night when you're walking around? A lot of times you see vagrants, you see alcoholics, you see drug dealers. They're in a stupor. They're walking around. But not one time in the hundreds and hundreds of cases I looked at in writing the book, not one time did it ever point to one of these people that disappeared. It's always high intellect, smart, athletic, and the oldest person I wrote about was 31. But most of them fall in that range from 18 to 23, 24. But not one criminal, not one alcoholic, not one drug addict. No, these were all superior, intelligent, the best of the best kind of guys.
The title, of course, the subtitle, A Sobering Coincidence, is not an accident.
No, and this is something that I think you have to really be careful with. And that's the reason at the beginning that I sort of pushed this to the side. And that is, the majority of these people that disappeared were found with very high levels of alcohol in their system. Now, they were also found with some other things in their system that even made it far more interesting. But many times, the person was found with such a high alcohol level that it didn't make sense to even the police that found him, because the police had interviewed him just before he disappeared, and he wasn't drunk at all. Yet he's found later with such a high alcohol level that they were completely confused how he got into his system. So it is a big concern. How did these people get these high levels of alcohol in their system if there was no opportunity from the time that the police saw them to the time they were found? And I got to say that somebody brought this up to me about a week ago, and I think it's an excellent statement. It's called plausible deniability. Somebody in the woods disappears. Hey, you don't know anything about it, but it's easy to go to your mind and say, hey, things happen like that. It's an animal attack. They just got lost. Stupidity, whatever. Now, in these cases, plausible deniability. Oh, the person was in a drunken stupor, staggered into the water, and drowned. That happens. It's a perfect statement to fit with both scenarios.
I was going to say the same thing, is that these people, so many of the cases you deal with, they've had some drinks, at least some drinks. So there is that's an excuse. People do not think clearly in these situations, so you can blame it that way. Do you think that they are being targeted because they've had a couple of drinks and because there could be plausible deniability?
I think that's possible, but I also think there's something else. There's a third factor that nobody understands right now, and that is, I go back to that statement I just made a minute ago about the police stopping this one student. He wasn't drunk. They ID'd him. They gave him some citations for some other things. It was on the record. Two cops had him. They let him go. He's found days later. He disappeared that night. The bars were closed. There were no parties. He was within yards of his house. He's found in the river, dead, with a super high blood alcohol level. Even the chief of police in the town couldn't understand it.
Again, before we get into the specific cases, the other characteristics we're looking for that are the same as in the rural areas, are dogs brought into these cases? Is that part of what's going on here?
Many, many times. Canines are brought in. They can't find a scent. They bring in cadaver-sniffing canines, and they don't pick up a scent. And they can't figure out that there was even the suspect there, the victim there. There's a direct water relationship. The vast, vast majority of these people were found in water. A few cases, two were found in another location, but it doesn't make sense. Geographical clusters, absolutely. On the back of the book, there's a map where I show the clusters. victims found unconscious or semi-conscious? Absolutely. Victims found missing clothes or missing shoes? There's a couple cases in this book that absolutely will turn the cops' heads trying to understand how the person got from A to B with absolutely clean socks through a muddy field. How did they get in the water if their socks are completely clean? The cops even brought it up.
Can we talk about the geographical clusters for a moment? Just give me, and we'll touch on it again as we go down the list of cases, but which cities come to mind that the audience should be aware of?
So on the East Coast, you can't deny that New York City and Boston have some of these cases, and in fact, many of these cases. Chicago has many of these cases. Eau Claire, Wisconsin has many of these cases. Madison has them. Milwaukee has them. There's cities in Canada just across the Great Lakes that have them. Indiana has a couple of them. Unbelievably, Tempe, Arizona has three of them.
College towns.
Exactly correct.
Here's the part that jumps out at me, Dave, is that these people are missing for a while, but the cases that you outline in this book, they're dead. There's nobody who, at least I can't remember, people who are missing and they stay missing. We're talking about people who are dead, and maybe that's because you needed additional information for them, you know, from the police or whatever, for them to make it into this book.
They are dead. There's a couple of them that lived, and one specifically tells an unbelievable story, but and we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's a good one.
But I think that these people are somehow placed in the water, and many times they're dead before they go in. There's a statement that Kevin Gannon made, and I think it's so appropriate. It's called local reports for local consumption, meaning that there's probably never going to be an overseer that's going to read that report and challenge it. It's going to quell the community's concern if they write it in a specific way. Not necessarily outright lying, but let's just quell the concerns. Yet in multiple times in these cases, the parents knew their son wouldn't have done this. It didn't happen the way the coroner said. And they brought in a second medical examiner to review the findings. And in every time, they pointed out physical facts to the body and in the reports that proved that the student was alive when they went in the water or was completely dead before they went in the water, namely through physical evidence on the body. If you die on land, you tend to get something, these flies around your groin. Well, these kids are found in the water dead, and their body is in pristine condition. The local coroner says, oh, they drowned, and that's it. Well, Gannon and a few other detectives, really smart guys, were paying attention, and they said, well, this body doesn't look like it's been in the water for 55 days. And the parents agreed. And so they got a second opinion, and the medical examiner came back and said, oh, it wasn't in the body for 55 days. And there's physical effects that happen to your body in water. When the water temperature is a certain degree, the outside temperature is a certain degree, the body decomposes at a certain rate. Specifics happen to you. You lose your hair on your head. Something called degloving occurs. And in these cases that I write about, this hasn't happened. These boys were, and as is stated in several articles, it appears that these boys were held somewhere for a certain period of time. They died, and they dumped them in the water. And you might say, oh, Politis is completely insane. But when you read the reports, these are the facts.
Yeah, over and over again, a closer examination shows that these guys who are found in water were not there the whole time. They were somewhere else, and the physical evidence is pretty clear, and that's really spooky. It means they were somewhere else.
And, you know, the hard thing for me, and I wrote this in the book, there were many times I got tears in my eyes when I was writing the stories because I have a son that he just graduated from college, and I'm thinking, my God, this could have been my kid, and nobody is standing behind the parents and putting this all together and saying, what in the heck is going on? Local police chiefs are saying, oh, nothing's going on. A local chief in Wisconsin made a big appearance in front of an auditorium filled with people. Hey, you know what? There's nothing here. There's no evidence that ties all these cases together, and I'm thinking, this guy is completely insane. And the people in the room almost yelled him out of the room because they knew the facts like I'm talking to him here. And a couple of reporters told the facts. But the vast majority, the story is so scary on its face that most people don't want to touch it.
Well, it's also hard to get your head around, Dave. I mean, you mentioned somewhere in the book, I remember, that you're looking at it from 30,000 feet. If you're a police chief in some town or even a big city, you got to solve the cases in your jurisdiction. You're dealing with them. And, yeah, there's a little bit something weird, but this is a college kid who went to a party, got drunk, and now he's drowned. And, you know, coroner is ready to write it off, and they're glad to get it off the books. They don't see it from the same vantage point as you. The vantage point of there are other strange disappearances, similar circumstances, national parks and things of that sort. They don't have your viewpoint on it.
You know, through a third party, a medical examiner in a very large jurisdiction got a hold of me. And I actually flew out to meet with him. And this person said, Dave, you're onto something big. And I got to tell you that we know about this. And they said that the medical examiners in the world are a different kind of breed. They really understand the human body well. And one of the things that I write about in the book, one of the things I haven't touched on yet, is that in the majority of these cases where there isn't a resolution on the cause of death, it's undetermined. And they told me, they said, we know something unusual is going on. And we know that when we can't figure it out, we're going to dig deeper to try to understand it. And what you're looking at right here, many medical examiners across the U.S. know. And in order to bring resolution, they may say the person appeared to have died by drowning. And the public will read that as the person died by drowning. The facts don't show for sure that the person drowned, but the specific wording used leads you to a specific understanding. And if you, when I start to look at these cases after I met with this person, damn, if that wasn't the wording in a lot of these cases. In a lot of them, they straight up said, we don't know the cause of death.
It's weird for a medical examiner or a coroner to have to say, we don't know the cause of death. It's undetermined. You know, some body is pulled out of a lake. You presume they're drowned. Or you look for alcohol poisoning, or you look for blunt trauma, something like that. When you've got a dead body and you don't know the cause of death, it sticks in your head for these guys, I would imagine.
And after you read the book and the number of times I said that and I pointed to specific reports that said it, but just like you said, one town maybe has one or two of these, and not that big a deal. But again, when you look at it, stand back and you look at a U.S. map, it starts to come together, especially when all the facts leading up to the disappearance, the facts that the body presents on its own, and the conclusions by the medical examiner, it's overwhelming.
Let's get into some cases. Patrick McNeil, New York. And as I recall, I think he wanted to be an FBI agent, didn't he?
Boy, this one pulled at my heartstrings just because Patrick was a stellar, stellar kid. And his dad did exactly what I wanted to, what I would have done, guaranteed, if my son disappeared. Patrick, this occurred 2/17/97, 12:30 a.m. in New York, New York. He was a football player in high school. He moved on and attended Fordham University. His hometown was Port Chester, New York, basically known for the Lifesaver manufacturing of candies. But in February 97, he was a junior at Fordham, majoring in accounting, and his dream job was to be an FBI agent. And back in 97, I can tell you that to be an agent, you had to be either an accounting major or you had to be an attorney. And he was going that route. He was doing everything right. He drove a volunteer ambulance for the ambulance corps at Fordham. He was an intern for the New York City Department of Investigation. He was taking EMT classes in order to be a full-time ambulance driver while he was in school. And on the 16th of February, he went to a place called the Dapper Dog Bar at 1768 Second Avenue in Manhattan. And he was in there, and as happens in so many of these cases, nobody actually sees him leave the bar. He's in the bar. A girl tells him, hey, I'm going to be out of the bathroom in a minute. I'll leave with you and we'll take off. She comes out of the bathroom and he's gone. There's some rumors, none confirmed, that he left the bar and walked down the street. Again, those were just rumors. Someone allegedly saw him, but they could never find that someone. But that was the last time he was seen. So the search started almost immediately, and his dad, one of these guys who just said, okay, I don't care about work, I don't care about anything, I'm going to find my son, and he did everything he could. He was a predominant Republican Party member. He actually got Senator Alphonse D'Amato to help him. And lucky for the McNeil family, this was the first case that Kevin Gannon, who was, turned out to be a homicide detective in New York, this was one of the first cases he was given as a missing persons investigator. And Gannon, I got to tell you, probably did things that 99% of the cops would never have done, and that is take a serious look at a missing persons case. Most missing persons departments in major cities are underfunded, undermanned, and overwhelmed to the max. It's easy being a missing persons investigator and getting very callous, because a lot of times they turn out to be cases where the person just voluntarily disappeared, they have mental issues and they disappear, whatever. But Gannon, he went after this. Checked jails, hospitals, shelters, soup kitchens, found nothing. But he kept tight with the family. Now, 55 days later, Patrick McNeil is found in the East River in Upper New York near a place called Owl's Head Water Pollution Control. He's found 12 miles from the point he was last seen at that bar, and he's just wearing socks and boxers and jeans. That's it. No shoes, no shirt, no coat. And he's found floating face up. Now, if you understand water-related deaths, males, 95%, 99% of the time, they're floating face down. Women float face up. Men are found face down. He's found face up, which was super unusual. Now, the body goes to the coroner, and there's no evidence of hypothermia on the body, even though he disappeared February 17, 97, middle of winter almost. And the coroner found flies in the groin, meaning guaranteed he died on land. The cause of death listed by the coroner was drowning.
Huh.
Now, he
had
him
drown on land.
There you go. How can you have this disparity of facts? Now, local reports for local consumption. Who's going to look over this person's shoulder, and who's going to question it? So the weird part was, when Gannon saw the pictures of the body, he thought he saw, and others thought they saw, second and third degree burns on the head down to the torso. And they also saw what was possible ligature marks around the neck. Now, those ligature marks were explained by the coroner as being the tightening of the shirt around the neck, which I could see. But based on the reports and the photos, Gannon and his partners believed that the body could have only been in the water 3 to 4 days based on the physical effects the body showed. And he stated he believed he was held and later dumped in the river. Well, the family went out and got a real famous medical examiner named Cyril Wecht, and he looked at the facts, and he thought the body was bound, burned, and the person was killed and dumped in the river. Killed on land and dumped in the river. And nobody believed that the body could float from where they disappeared to where it was found. They thought it was impossible. So, in just this case, let's think about it. Forget about the burn marks, because that's the only time a body I could find anywhere had burn marks. But there was no cause of death related to the burn marks or any physical violence. None. And the coroner ruled he drowned. But again, it was impossible in the report because of flies in the groin. And also, a really unusual thing is there's something called postmortem lividity. Postmortem meaning after death. Lividity is the settling of human blood in the body at the lowest point when you die. Meaning when if you laid down on the ground and you died on your back, you're going to get the settling effect in your buttocks and in your back and on your shoulder. And it's going to look like a black and blue or a black and blue effect. In McNeil's body, there was no lividity. There was no lividity at all that could be found.
We're going to continue the conversation about Patrick McNeil, who obviously did not just wander away from a bar and fall into the water. He was held somewhere for 47 days. This is Pete Townsend and The Who, taking us into, from 1982, Eminence Front. We'll be right back. The unmistakable voice of Roy Orbison from 1961, running scared, anguish oozing out of his throat with every note there. We're talking with David Politis, whose new book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence, takes the unusual deaths and missing persons cases that have been reported in rural areas and brings it much closer to home into urban areas. We're just now hearing about some of the characteristics that make these cases jump out. We'll continue with more examples in just a moment. So we've been learning about the case of Patrick McNeil, who in 1997 in New York walked out of a bar and was never seen alive again. He had a girl in the bar who was ready to leave with him. She went to the bathroom, came back. Patrick McNeil is gone. For 47 days, he was held somewhere because it was 50 days he was found in the water. But for 47 of those days, he was held somewhere. Dave, why couldn't it just be he walks out of the bar to wait for the girl outside. Some weirdo grabs him, snatches him, holds him, kidnaps him, tortures him maybe, and then tosses the body into the water 50 days later.
So if we stop there, possible. I mean, it would be hard to deny that that wasn't an option. But when you look at 120-plus cases, and the exact same scenario plays out time after time after time, you start to say, okay, this is where coincidence stops and crime is acknowledged at some level. But nobody, I don't care who you are, is 100% effective at taking somebody, especially these young people that are athletic. They're going to put up one heck of a fight. And when they're fighting, that draws a crowd, people see things. Not in one of these cases is anybody seen at that exact moment of critical tension when they're leaving the bar, when a camera's on them, when you expect to be seen. These people aren't seen. There's a couple incidents we'll talk about later where it would be impossible to get out of the bar without being on camera, yet they were never on the camera. So how did they get out of the bar?
We will get into those. Talk to me about drinking in general, drinking and death. You have a couple of drinks, you're not thinking clearly, you make bad decisions. That happens if you have enough to drink. But it seems like, and I'm not sure I can remember if you ever enunciate this in the book exactly, but it seems like these people are making decisions like they're in a trance, that they're not even under their own control, that they're not in control of their own actions. What do you think about that?
So I talk about that a little bit in the book, and I say, so if you're a man and you have one 12-ounce beer, that equals to 0.02 percentage of blood alcohol in your system. If you're a woman, it's about 0.03 to 0.04, depending on your weight. The legal limit for driving in most states in the United States is 0.08. And at 0.08, you're functional, you're able to move machinery around, probably not able to do it safely, but you're not in a stupor. And most people, you're not going to be in that stupid sense until you're way over 0.15. And you're still going to understand when something happens. Meaning, if I fall into a lake or into a river, I'm not going to hold my breath and not try to get out and just fall into the river and give up and die. You're going to fight. You're going to try to get out. And in all of these incidents, just as you explained, George, the person goes in the water and they're not coming out. And like you said, and like I've said in my other work and the other books, person is found semi-conscious or unconscious. And when you see the pictures of the people that are found, their eyes look like dishpans in their head, super wide open. It's like this blank deer in the headlights kind of stare. They're laying there. They're alive, but they're not moving. And as we walk down this road, there's some indicators of why this is happening.
It seems like, you know, there's so many of the cases in the book where they're a couple of blocks from home. They're going to take a little walk, a little stroll down the street, and then they just go completely off the track. They walk past their house, or they try to get into some other place, or they just go in a completely different direction, which is not consistent with the amount of alcohol they've had. I mean, the judgments they're making is way off the charts.
And the families and their friends and girlfriends say the exact same thing. I've read this dozens and dozens of times, completely out of character, way outside the bounds of what they normally do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it can't all be attributed, and it's not all attributed to alcohol in many instances. But it does appear as though something else is happening. Now, not necessarily in McNeil's case, but in many of these cases, the victims are going to be found in a location that had been searched dozens of times. And many times, law enforcement says, oh, they're not there. Don't worry about it. And one of the profile points in the books I write, and in fact, I go at great lengths to talk about it in my previous book, is that I think over 175 times, people were found in a location that had been searched sometimes hundreds of times. And this isn't saying that the search and rescue people are doing an inferior job. Because remember, the canines can't even find them. There's no scent of them there. And then all of a sudden, they are there. So my take on that is, I don't think they were there when they were looking.
Yeah, it's like they vanish, they're held somewhere else for a while, and then they're brought back and dumped.
And, you know, some of the people will say, oh, you guys are just really nuts. But if you follow the logic and you follow the facts, I don't see what other conclusion you can come to.
All right, Boston is another of your urban clusters. William Hurley is one of the cases that really jumped out at me because of some of the circumstances surrounding this disappearance. He was known as Mr. Reliable. Talk about that.
Again, one of those people, stellar individual, Mr. Reliable, never late, a man of his word. He was raised, and he was 24 years old. This incident happened October 8th, 2009, in downtown Boston. Raised in Nashville, North Carolina, he joined the Navy out of high school. Most of the time, he was stationed in Florida. In one incident, his military group was pulled, and they had to go up to Boston to do something. He was on leave, and while he was on leave, he met a girl named Claire Mahoney on St. Patrick's Day. And Claire and William ended up being just the love of each other's life. After he got out of the Navy, they lived together in Quincy, Mass. Well, he worked at a country club, and he was their groundskeeper. In October 8, 2009, he woke up at 4:30 a.m. like he did every day to go to work. He worked at a place called Weston Country Club in Weston, Mass. Well, his best buddy at work was Brendan Venti. And that day when William got to the club, Brendan said, hey, I've got two tickets to go to the Bruins game tonight. How about if we go? So William called Claire, explained it, and she goes, yeah, go, have fun. And so they left after they got off work, and the Bruins were playing the Ducks at a place called TD Gardens Arena in downtown Boston. And it sits very near the confluence of a couple different rivers. And at the end of the first period, William just got tired. He told Brendan that he'd call Claire and he was going to go home. Now, you're going to hear this time after time after time. Person says they're tired, person is tired, person says they're leaving. William, an honorable guy, reliable, needs to go to work, realizes he's tired, tells his buddy, I'm going to leave. Leaves, calls Claire. Claire says, okay, I'll drive down there and I'll pick you up. As she's en route there, she's about a mile away, she calls. And she gets William on the phone, they start talking. She's driving towards the arena. She's about two blocks away, and she says, what's your exact location? In the background, William's asking somebody, and she hears them yell out, 99 Nashua Street. And at that point, he tells her, hey, I think my phone's going to go dead. It goes dead. Another key point in these cases that you'll read about time after time, the people are on the phone goes dead. Sometimes it goes dead because the person says, hey, I think I'm losing power. Sometimes it just goes dead for no reason. And I write about this many times, and it can't be all coincidence. Claire was around the corner. She turns the corner on Nashua Street, doesn't see anything. So she drives around. She pulls up to the arena. She stops, gets out of the car, honks her horn, walks around the area for an hour, can't find anything. So she drives home, calls the police department where she lives, and calls Boston PD. They tell her you can't file a missing persons report for 24 hours. The following day, she files a missing persons report, and she goes out with her mom, and they put out flyers all over. They don't find anything. But they file a report. On Monday, Boston PD puts two boats in the water right behind the arena looking for William. They find nothing. But what they did find is they found his cell phone smashed into a million pieces. And they never said where they found that, but they did positively identify it. another important point. Many times when the victims are found, they're found without their cell phone. Now, something to think about with that is many times your cell phone has a GPS device with it that'll show where you are, and I've been reminded of that hundreds of times by people. Well, 6 days after he disappears on October 14th, a Boston police officer is on routine patrol near the Suffolk County Jail on Nashua Street, and he sees something in the water. Calls for a marine unit to respond. 25 feet from shore, they pick up William's body with his wallet and keys on the body. The district attorney's statement is important here. He says, William was found in the water, and it shows that he was in the water for a couple of days. Important? Yes. William was gone for 5 days and 6 hours. They put him in the water for a couple of days, and they could never determine the cause of his death. Suspicious? I think so.
Weird about the telephone, the cell phone. He was on the phone. His girlfriend is coming to pick him up. She's less than a minute away, and he tells her where he is. Less than a minute later, she pulls onto that street, and he's not there. And then the cell phone is found smashed into a million pieces, but they won't tell you where. That's pretty weird.
And you got to remember, I mean, the common person's going to say, well, you know, maybe it was some kind of violence. No, there was no violence. They couldn't determine the cause of death. There was no violence to the body. He didn't drown. It's another one of those unusual cases. And there's a whole bunch of them in Boston that I write about.
You had mentioned in the book about this case that it sort of typifies how news media accept the idea of people dead in the water. Well, yeah, okay, fine. He must have drowned. Nothing unusual about that.
And boy, I've been hit with this many times, and I don't want to press the media too hard, but...
Go ahead. That's all right.
You're one of those weird guys, George, where you will dig where most people won't dig, and you will find things that most people will never even try to find. And it's too bad that there aren't a million George Knapps out there in the world asking the tough questions. But somebody's found in the water, and I'm sure Claire Mahoney's going, and the family's going, wait a minute, how did he get in the water? He was standing on the sidewalk. How did his phone get in a million pieces? If you can't determine how he died, why can't you determine how he died? How long was he in the water exactly? Why isn't someone looking into this? If he wasn't in the water for 5 days and 6 hours, why aren't you concerned about where he was for the other, you know, 3 or 4 days?
Are you having any luck with the media? I know it's still early. This book is just coming out. But as you try to interest reporters, big city reporters, in these kinds of cases, are they nibbling? Are they biting?
Well, we're going to find out because 50 of the books went out to some. What we did is we found the articles that some of these cases were originally written by their authors. And actually, some of these reporters are now in pretty big-time positions at some of the biggest publications in the world. And they went to them 2 weeks ago. Haven't heard anything since, but I'm going to see if this can tweak some interest in some people since they originally wrote about many of these.
So that's a great idea. So do you include a note that says, hey, you wrote about this case. It's on page 45. Check it out.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I did.
Well, that's a great idea because, you know, reporters, the good ones, they get a case, it gets under their skin, they never forget it. A murder, a missing persons case, if they talk to the family, they get to know them, those images are burned in their brain and they don't forget it. So that's a great strategy. In general, the media about the other books, the earlier missing 411 books, have you had much luck in reeling them in on that stuff?
You know, absolutely not. A few of the families have come back and reached out to me, and we've talked at length about this. And they are as frustrated as I am and you would be. And I can think of two cases specifically where the families are the nicest people you'll ever want to meet. They've got no answers. They were lied to incessantly, and they talk about it. On the movie trailer that we made, two of those families are on there predominantly talking about how they were lied to, how the people don't want to tell them the truth. They don't want to find out the truth. They don't want to look for a body. They get rebuffed. They won't even be approached. They won't even walk to the front desk of the National Park Service to address them.
There's a case that is in the chapter that you call Key Cases. Todd Geib.
Well, you know, there's all these cases are strange, but some of these just are unbelievable that something isn't being done about it. Todd, 22 years old, June 11th, 2005, in Casnovia, Michigan, about 25 miles north of Grand Rapids, this little town. Well, there's actually an established cluster of missing people about 50 miles north of Casnovia that I've established near Weber and Ludington and Baldwin. But Guy was an outdoorsman, liked to trophy fish, liked to deer hunt. He knew the outdoors well, played basketball and baseball when he was younger. He had a very dry sense of humor that everyone appreciated, and he had strong religious ties to being Protestant and Catholic. His one vice was smoking. Interesting is one article stated that Todd had a German and Polish background. What is fascinating about this is that backgrounds on people and their heritage aren't talked a lot about in these missing person reports and things. But one that comes up 80% of the time compared to all others is German. And there are three people that have disappeared this past 4 months in wilderness areas. Heimer, Kuntz, and Keller, all German. And they were never found. So I think that German side of things, I pay very close attention to. And the people that are listening to me, I have no understanding why that might be the case. The German comes up more than anything.
Well, Knapp is a good German name, so you've got my attention. But tell us a little bit about Todd and the specifics of his disappearance.
So on June 11th, 05, at about 6:30, he drove from his parents' home to his house where his cousin was his roommate. They spoke for a while. At 7:30, he met a bunch of friends down at a local bar, had some drinks. At 9:30, they left the bar and they walked to a local party, an annual party that was held in this orchard very nearby. There was a keg, bonfire, 50 people from the area all knew each other, and they hung out and they drank. Well, at 12 a.m., Todd told friends he was tired. Again, I'm telling you that this tired thing comes up all the time. It was about a mile to his house, and he said, "Hey, I'm not driving. I'm just going to walk it." He's a reliable guy. And he knew the area, the specific area, like the back of his hand. He grew up in it. He hunted it. He fished it. He knew it. As he leaves, the story told in various articles is that after he left, he made four phone calls as he was walking, from 12:45 to 1 a.m. At 12:47, he called his friend, and he said he was in a field. Boom, the calls dropped. The friend called back, and he heard heavy breathing and or wind. He couldn't determine what it was. Another call said that he had trouble breathing and was in a field, and the call went dead. Now, what's interesting about this is if there was a case just north of there in Baldwin with an individual named Cullen Finnerty, who was an NFL football player, quarterback. And he did the same thing. He was fishing. He got lost. He called his wife. Heavy breathing. The wife called back. No answer. Phones dropped. Cullen's found days later dead in a field. Same sort of circumstances. So the next day, Todd was supposed to be at a family event. He didn't show up. His family was super close. Huge search starts from the get-go. There were some rumors, false rumors, about an altercation at the party between Todd and another person. Not true. They bring in canines to the point where Todd was last seen walking into the woods. Canines couldn't find any scent at all after a short trip into the woods. On June 13th, 100 searchers combed the area from top to bottom, multiple helicopters and canines on the ground. They found nothing.
Hold on there, Dave. Warren Zevon is telling us we need to take a break. We'll pick up the story of Todd Geib in just a moment, and then we're going to tell the tale of the guy who was dead for a long time and came back to life. Much more to come with Dave Politis talking about his new book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence. And as I said, Warren Zevon takes us into the break. The group is Angels and Airwaves. The song is Into the Night. And when I say that's a new song, I'm not kidding. It's so new, it hasn't been released yet. Our friend Tom DeLong, who's the front man for Angels and Airwaves, gave us the green light to do the radio debut. That album comes out on September 4th, and Tom has been our guest on this program a couple of times in the past. He's got so many irons in the fire, it's hard to describe them all. Not only a new album, but a film coming out and some books. And We're going to have to get him back on the program real soon. For now, we're talking with Dave Politis about his new book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence. It's been spooky up to this point. It's about to take a really dark turn when we come back and get into some of these other cases that will just blow your mind. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Dave Politis talking about the case of Todd Guibe, and this case really gets creepy. Dave, please continue.
So, catch up is a massive search. Todd isn't being found. Canines aren't finding a scent. Helicopters aren't seeing anything from the skies. All the swamps were searched. All the lakes in the area were searched. Nothing's found. His residence is on west side of a place called Half Moon Lake. Kind of on the right, on the correct side is the party. Party was on the west side of the road as well. And as the searchers are going, there's one small body of water on the west side as well, and it's called Ovid Hall Lake. It's about 1,000 feet long, and it's narrow. It had been looked at many, many times. It's not easily acceptable. Some locals fish it. You can't drive to it, and you have to walk to it, and it's a tough walk. It's in the exact opposite direction of where Todd needed to go from the party to his house. Well, people did fish the lake from May 17th to May 18th afterwards, and they were using a fish finder, and they combed the lake from top to bottom, left to right. There was nothing in the lake of a human body size. The people were interviewed multiple times. On July 2nd at 5 p.m., a husband and wife were walking down to the lake, and they saw what they described as something really odd protruding from the water. This is July 2nd. There's no ice. You know, it's a warm Michigan day. They walk down, and it's Todd's body. And the witnesses said in the reports that he was floating like a bobber. Todd's hat, his cell phone, and one shoe were missing. He was totally gone for 21 days. His location absolutely shocked everyone because it was on that opposite direction that he should have been going. The on-scene coroner classified in his report the case as suspicious, which is never done unless there's a crime involved. The coroner couldn't find any rigor mortis in the body. There was no ice in the lake. He couldn't determine if any lividity was present at all. And again, that's you always find lividity in bodies, except in these cases. Decomposition was classified as intermediate to moderate. He had the hair still on his head, and there was swelling around his eyelids. They couldn't determine the color of his iris. That's the colored portion of your eye. Now, when Gannon and Gilbertson looked at this case, they described his body as being pristine for being in the water 21 days. His blood alcohol level came back at 0.12%. just a little over the legal limit for driving. A toxicology showed that he had what's called contanine. It's a byproduct of smoking. But highly unusual is they found something called despermine. It's a depression medication. Todd wasn't on depression medication. He wasn't taking any drugs. He was a very level-headed guy. They also found something called amitriptyline in his system. And again, he didn't take drugs. They couldn't believe that they found this stuff. They couldn't determine the cause of death. It was listed as undetermined how he died, even though drowning was a possibility. They didn't find any water in his lungs. It's another case where the parents reach out to Dr. Cyril Wecht. He reviewed the case. He said that Todd had to have been dead or unconscious when he entered the water. The photos of the body were taken to a medical examiner's conference, and it was the unanimous opinion of all the medical examiners that looked at the pictures is that the body wasn't in the water for 20-plus days. The opinion was that Todd was out of the water 15 to 18 days, placed in the water, and the family tried to get the Michigan police to change the cause of death from possible drowning to murder. They wouldn't look at it. They wouldn't have anything to do with it. Now, everyone needs to understand something. Police departments, cities, counties, they work off of statistics. And most police chiefs want to keep that homicide statistic down because it's bad for business. And to change something from a drowning, which nobody really cares about, to murder, everybody cares about. Now, not only is it just murder, but there's also got to be kidnapping or abduction along with this. You can't ignore that. And again, I'm going to present you with facts, not opinions, about what's going on. The fact is, Todd wasn't in that water for that entire period of time.
There are quotes that you have in the book from the guy's family, obviously pretty upset, and upset about the determination that the officials say it's not a homicide. How can it not be a homicide? This, you say, he's a big guy. He died on land. Somebody had to drag him, carry him, toss him into that water.
Well, and the other part of this that people can't forget is the positioning of the body that's being found in these cases, completely outside the bounds of what's normal. What's causing the bodies to end up in this position? Nobody knows. But something unusual, highly unusual, is happening. And yes, the parents say things, but George, in every one of these cases, the parents are saying, there's no way this is my son. There's no way this happened. He knew this area like his backyard. He's not going to be walking in the other direction. But it's irrelevant. He didn't go the other direction. It's proven through a scientific forensics, Todd Guybe and these other people that we've talked about were not in the water the entire time.
What do you make of the drugs, then? These substances he didn't take. He didn't have a prescription for this stuff. No one had ever known him to take it. It wasn't him at all. And yet, high levels of that stuff's in his system. How does that happen? How does that fit into the picture?
So this fits into the picture pretty well, actually. And it wasn't until relatively recently that I started to get a handle on this. And it goes back to this plausible deniability. Now, in my previous books, I write about these victims being found in areas that were previously searched. It goes back to the claw machine I talked about in the arcade. They're dropped into an area, they're placed into an area somehow where they guaranteed weren't in the area before. When they're found, if they're found alive, they're found in this semi-conscious or unconscious state, which apparently is these certain kinds of drugs that are in their system, they're being placed in their system for some reason, maybe to make them more workable, maybe to make them pliable so they won't fight. I don't know, but these drugs are along those depression-related type drugs, and we're going to talk about more of those drugs, one specifically later. But it's all the parents say, there's no way my son would have ever taken this stuff. And I know there's a lot of people out there saying, well, you know, kids take stuff that parents don't really know. I agree, but there's one drug that's going to come up time and time and time again that's never tested in toxicology screening and shows up time after time after time. Why? Because certain coroners are getting smart, certain cops are getting smart, and they're taking a second look at this, and they're saying, okay, right away, let's screen for this.
We'll come back to that. You look at the whole book, and over again, these tiny little things that come up. I'm tired. I want to go home. I am not feeling well. I want to go home. Like something comes over people. Almost as if drugs or something is put into their system without their permission or knowledge, it makes them not feel well, and then they go home, and then that's when stuff happens. It's like something is slipped into their system or their mental condition changes again and again. You look at one of those cases, it doesn't pop out at you, but when you see a pattern looking at it as you do from 30,000 feet, it becomes pretty striking.
Exactly, and I think the mind of most would go right to that, well, there's a criminal element, you know, you slipped something in the drink. But you got to remember something. The canines, there's no tracks leaving the area. The canines, there's no scent leaving the area. So even if somebody would have picked Todd up and carried him out of the area, chances are trackers, et cetera, would have tracked him out of the area. They would have found his scent someplace else. But then again, he wasn't in the water the entire time. So that means he was held. Nobody, I don't care who you are, in 125 cases, leaves no evidence behind. And really, there's no evidence behind of who's doing this or what's happening.
Whoever's doing it is pretty good at it.
I would say perfect.
Let's talk about Shane Montgomery. This is in Philadelphia, 2014.
Now, in my previous books, I've written time and time again about the FBI. And the FBI are the best in the world at documentation. I don't care what you say. These guys are the these guys and ladies are the best. And they could go and they could sit and they monitor a case. They don't get involved, but they just sit and watch. And they listen and they write. And these reports go back to their profiling unit for review and classification. And they're the best at profiling. They're the best at accumulating data. And in my past books, I've said that the FBI continually are on scene at some of these crimes, and they're writing, and they are not idiots. They know what I know, and I'm sure for a fact they know 10,000 times more. But they seem to show up. The Shane Montgomery case, to me, is a turning point for the FBI involvement, because from the time Shane went missing, the FBI was on the scene. And just not the FBI agents themselves, the FBI abduction task force agents were there, yet there was no evidence of a crime. November 27, 2014, is when Shane, 21 years old, Philadelphia, PA, he was a graduate of a Roman Catholic high school. I'll stop there again. You're going to continually hear me say that the majority of these people that disappear have some strong religious affiliations. Shane did. Graduated from a Roman Catholic high school and was attending Westchester University in Philly. On November 26th, he was at his cousin's house, and both decided they were going to go to a bar and have some drinks. At about 1:15 a.m., Shane sent a text to his cousin saying he was in the bar but couldn't locate his cousin. At 1:28, he called another friend and said, "Do you know where my cousin's at?" Got no answer, couldn't find him. At 1:45, he bumped into something in the restaurant, and he was told that it's near 2 a.m., you guys got to leave. People said there was no way he was staggering drunk. He left the bar and was never seen again. He didn't show up for a family event on November 27th, late in the day, and the family reported him as a missing person. From the first day Philadelphia police started working this event, the FBI was there interviewing staff at the bar at Cadell's Pub. This is the first time I've ever seen the FBI there interviewing staff on an incident where there was no evidence of a crime, and Philadelphia police said there was no evidence of a crime. They were just investigating. Well, the FBI doesn't investigate missing people. Small children, there's one classification for that, but they won't investigate straight missing people. Now, they did locate a closed-circuit television footage of Shane crossing between a pub and a parking lot over a small footbridge of a canal. The footbridge passed over what was called Manayunk Canal, which paralleled the Schuylkill River. Shortly after he disappeared, the parents convinced Garden State Underwater Recovery Team to come in and start searching the water for their son, because there was really no other place for him to go in their mind. And the first break came on December 21st. Now, that was almost 3 weeks after he disappeared. This team is so good, they found Shane's keys in the river. Not in the canal they saw him walking over, but in the river. And that to me, is just unbelievable they found the keys. And the search was initially focused on that canal, but when they cleared it, they moved to the river. Now, what's fascinating about this is that one of the detectives on the case was interviewed by a news team, and he was standing next to the river and they were talking about Shane, and he said, "Well, if Shane's in the river, he's miles downstream at this point because the river's flowing so fast." And they said, "Oh, okay," and they interviewed him about some other stuff. Well, the same underwater recovery team that found his keys in 10 feet of water continued to look, and they looked behind a variety of locations in the area he was in. Well, days later, almost a month after he disappeared, they found his body in an exact location right behind where he was seen, in an area that had been searched many times, behind a brewery. And this was in the exact location where he was seen on CCTV. Now, how did he end up in the river behind the brewery in a location that had been searched many times when the detective said there's no way he'd be anywhere near there, it'd be washed all downstream? That was funny. You know? That didn't make any sense. And the family said that the coroner told them that the cause of death was accident, but they never stated exactly what caused the death. The body was assisted and reported and investigated by not only the FBI, but local Philadelphia authorities. And as of last week, the coroner and the medical examiner have never released the report on the cause of death, nor the blood alcohol level.
Are you encouraged by this interest by the FBI? I mean, I guess you want the best detectives in the world, the best bloodhounds on the case looking at this. But then you have to wonder, well, maybe they know a lot more than you do, and they probably do know a lot more than you do, but would they ever release it, as, you know, other government agencies have been reluctant to do?
Well, I've filed Freedom of Information Acts against the FBI before in cases, and you get a redacted document that one word of out of every 20 is readable and everything else is blacked out, so you never really get anything. So in one sense, I think, well, yeah, they're there. But what's interesting about this is back when I was a cop, there was a girl who disappeared in Petaluma, California, named Polly Kloss. And the FBI Child Abduction Task Force agents, same guys working in this case with Shane Montgomery, were pulled, and they all flew in the next day, and they worked this case with Polly Kloss. One of the abduction task force agents knew one of our guys and said, yeah, pick yourself and one other guy and come up here. And I was the other guy. And these abduction task force guys, they are the best of the best. I often tell people, you know, the average FBI agent probably doesn't put his handcuffs on a person once a year. These child task force agents, they are all ex-cops. They are really on top of things. If I ever had a family member disappeared, these are the guys I want looking into it because they are great. And, yeah, it in a way it makes me feel better. But in another way, I know that whatever they find, we'll never know because they'll never say – they won't even tell the other police officers working cases next to them what they know sometimes.
I can't remember if the FBI ever showed up in any of those National Park Service, National Forest missing persons cases, disappearances. Is there any hint that they are involved in any of those?
Oh, yeah. In fact, in Missing 411 Eastern U.S., I wrote about an entire series of disappearances that occurred in the Great Smoky Mountains. And there was one specific FBI agent that was assigned to follow these strange disappearances of people in the woods. And I forgot how many times, but it was a lot of times. It was the same agent, the same name, time after time. And all he would say is, we're monitoring the case, we're monitoring the case. Well, when I interviewed one of the victim's dads, Dennis Martin, small boy, disappeared, was never found. I was really fortunate to have an interview with his dad. And I asked him, I said, well, what is there about this case that I don't know? Because I think I probably know everything in print. And he says, you know that FBI agent that worked all the cases here? I go, yeah, his last name was Reich. He says, exactly. He goes, do you ever know what happened to Agent Reich? I said, no. He says, he committed suicide.
Oh.
I later confirmed that Reich did commit suicide. I don't know why, and that's all I know.
Well, that would be an interesting file to file a FOIA on, is his file. You know, the FBI does not handle missing persons cases, but, of course, they handle kidnapping. So maybe some determination has been made that a few of these that they popped up in are kidnappings. It'd be interesting to figure out how they knew and how they categorized it that way.
Absolutely. And, you know, you and I and everybody that has 1 ounce of common sense, when you look at the physical facts, there's obviously some kind of kidnapping abduction that's occurring. But in many of these cases, they won't say that they're there investigating that.
All right, there's a case coming up. We're going to go to a break here in just a moment, but there's a case coming up of a guy, Stephen Kubacki, who was dead, and then suddenly he showed up very much alive. It's a heck of a case, and I think it'll chill you to your bones. Bob Seger takes us into the break from 1976, Come to Papa. That's Bonnie Raitt sort of putting her cards on the table, Love Me Like a Man from 1972. So far, the victims we're talking about in these missing 411 cases that Dave Politis has outlined have all been men. But although it's predominant, it's not exclusive. Coming up in a moment, a case from L.A. where the victim was a woman. And then we'll get into, gosh, just the weirdest case you have ever heard, this guy Stephen Kubacki. And when you hear the details, it's going to, I don't know, your head might explode. Stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. The book is called Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence. Dave, is it out yet?
Yes, it is.
How do people get it?
On our website, CanAm, C-A-N as in Nora, A-M as in Mary, CanAmMissing.com.
And do you sell it on Amazon or other outlets like that, or just on the website?
Funny you ask that. No, we don't sell on Amazon, don't sell any of our books on Amazon, and the outrageous prices you see on Amazon are charged by resellers, not by us.
Yeah, I hear that from some time to time. People write and say, hey, your buddy Dave Politis is really ripping us off. He wants $100 for his book, something like that.
Yeah, that's outrageous, and I would agree. And we try to stop it the best we can, but it's tough to determine who these resellers are. But they buy it from us, and they put it up there at some outrageous price. And all you have to do is just Google Missing 411. It'll take you to our site. But no, we don't sell there.
I want to go back to the Todd Guibe case before we get to these other two really weird ones, because there was something I wanted to ask you about that I overlooked, and that was you mentioned he made 4 phone calls from what he described as some kind of a field. Were those two all different people?
So this is an important point, because first one was to a friend, and then the other calls weren't made public who they made them to, but there's an entire series of these that I write about in the book where right before the person disappears, and I mean right before, they're on the phone or they're calling somebody. And then at that point, they're separated from the conversation somehow. And sometimes the people get out a sentence. Sometimes they'll say something like, oh, my God, where are you? It's like your last word you ever hear from the person, and then they're not found.
One of those, I don't remember which case it was, but you said the guy had dialed 911 and the call lasted 1 second and then poof, it's dead.
And sometimes if you drop a phone on the ground, it will automatically dial 911 sometimes. Other times, maybe it was them actually looking for help. I don't know.
In the Todd Guibe thing, you mentioned something I didn't remember from the book, but I thought that the witnesses said it was the sound of either heavy breathing or wind. What made me think of is Todd flying through the air.
George, you're not the first guy to think that. There were probably 25 of these books that went out as review copies, and I got probably 5 or 6 of those type of responses. And it's hard not to go there right away. I try not to, but I think there could be something to that.
Let's go to Stephen Kabacki. I've been saving this one, and I hope I didn't oversell it too much, but this just really blew my mind. And take it away.
So Stephen, 23 years old at the time, February 19th, 78, another February disappearance, this time in Holland, Michigan. And it's interesting that we're talking about Todd Guibe. Holland is just north of Casnovia, also in an area where there's been these clusters of strange disappearances. And also, Stephen, again, was strong religious ties. He was going to Hope College, which is part of the Reformed Church of America. This location that he was at is 30 miles north of South Haven, 76 miles south of Ludington and Baldwin, the cluster area I was telling you about. In February of 78, Stephen was attending Hope, and this is the part that's going to sound strange again. He was trying to get a degree in German. On February 19th, Todd told his roommates he was going to go cross-country skiing along Lake Michigan near Saugatuck, and when he didn't return, they filed a missing persons report. The Michigan State Police led the search, and they pulled out every stop imaginable. The Coast Guard on Lake Michigan went out, tracking dogs, helicopters, foot patrols, and the state police found his skis and his poles on the beach of Lake Michigan. And they saw footprints on the ice leading out 200 yards out onto the lake. And they flew over it, and the footprints just appeared to stop. And they thought at the time that, because it had been a couple days, that maybe he had just fallen through the ice, died, and because there were no tracks coming back. And another report stated that they found his backpack in the same general area. So he was essentially separated from everything he had and apparently walked out on the ice. And the determination that after a couple week searches, police wrote down that they believed he died and drowned on the lake. Now, fast forward to May 5th, 79. This all occurred February 1978, so, you know, you're looking at about 15 months later. Stephen says he woke up in a field on a Saturday night, 40 miles from his father's house in Deerfield, Massachusetts. John Kubacki was his dad. 53-year-old father told in interviews, he goes, "I thought my son was dead." And he said that he walked up to the door and said that he doesn't remember a lot. He woke up in Pittsfield, said he was lying in a meadow, and he was wearing clothes that weren't his. Now, this is 700 miles east of Lake Michigan, almost in a straight line. Now, in 1983, Stephen went back out and got an M.A. in linguistics from Ohio University. And in 92, he went back to the University of New Mexico and got a Ph.D. in clinical psychology. I tracked him down into Washington. I called, tried to make a contact with him, told the receptionist I wanted to talk to him, sent him a personal email that I wanted to talk to him. He would never respond. Now, what's important about this, he's a missing student. He's missing in an area that is quoted as the Great Lakes Triangle, and I talk about this in my book. That is a great book that talks about a series of disappearances in and around the water of people, planes, and boats that are as unusual as the disappearances I talk about in my book. Stephen's missing time and space, and reporters asked him if he'd ever see a psychiatrist, and he said no, because I don't have any problems.
So he had to have been interviewed by police, his family. Hey, where you been? What did he say?
I wish I knew. Because in all of the articles I pulled on this, it never said that the police took an interest in it, never said that. Because if you think about it, there was no crime that occurred. Remember, anybody can disappear, and it's not a crime. Now, there's some pretty strong evidence that there was factual evidence. He walked out on the ice, right directly from where his skis and things were. So where was he for 15 months? He says he wakes up in a field wearing somebody else's clothes. He said that there was other things in a small satchel that was next to him that were maps and things that weren't his, and he doesn't know where it came from.
The thing about clothes, in his case and in other cases, it pops up all the time, that you got different items of clothing. I remember, I know you don't want to be necessarily associated with alien abduction cases, but there are quite a few of those cases where people are wearing their clothes, but they're on backwards or inside out from when they went to bed. There's a missing time, a missing memory kind of a thing, and they've got their clothes are totally, totally wrong. This guy woke up with somebody else's clothes, seemingly in a trance. I suppose, talk about the importance of that.
Well, again, going back to what you just said, I write about cases in past books where young children were found and their sweatshirt was on backwards, or they were missing clothes, and the parents stated that they couldn't undress themselves and they had no idea how this thing got on backwards, or in another case, how the child ever got their clothes off. So, and you know, I think I've talked to you about this before, the work of John Mack. I've read his books, and he was a psychiatrist from Harvard who was studying the abduction phenomena, and he wrote extensively about some of the things we're talking about right here. And it's not that I want to ignore it at all, because I do see that there is some correlation in the facts between what I've written about and what Mack presented.
Well, you don't want to box yourself into a corner, and you know, you don't want people necessarily assume that you're talking about alien abductions, but these are abductions. I don't know exactly who's doing them, but they are abductions. There's no question about that. I know that word carries a particular context on this program and these kinds of circles, and maybe you're not comfortable with that, but these are abductions, no doubt about it.
Oh, no, and I think I'd be a fool not to admit that now. I mean, there's been some of the most competent police officers and detectives around that have said, hey, these are abductions. People don't want to admit it. They don't want to sit there and address the facts, but I'd go toe-to-toe with anybody to say, hey, show me that they're not.
Stephen, this guy we're talking about, he's gone for 14 months. I mean, couldn't he have just, I guess he wandered off, had a girlfriend he didn't want to tell the family about. He ended up living with her, and then he pretends he has amnesia when he comes back. Suppose?
Again, anything is possible, but I think that the reality of the facts that presented themselves would say, no, that wouldn't be true. And unless Stephen was a very well-read guy back in 79 and knew about the clothing, the wrong clothing, the ill-fitting clothing, how would he know that this fits into other scenarios that I've written about? How would he know that this area of Michigan has had a whole series of disappearances that are equally strange to his? I mean, the parallels to other things are just phenomenal.
He's a clinical psychologist these days, you say, with a practice in Seattle, Washington. I just wonder if we have some listeners in Seattle who might know him, who might have some insight into his story. Maybe what we need is somebody to get an appointment with him as a patient or something and then bring up the subject. I mean, ideally, what you'd like, and you mentioned it in the book, what you'd ideally like is for him to undergo hypnotic regression and see if he could remember where the heck he was all the time.
And again, this wouldn't be to embarrass him. It would be, he would help out hundreds of other people that have, and families that have gone through similar scenarios to what he did. He's one of the few that ever came back.
Well, maybe he's got your letter, Dave, and he's thinking about it. We sure hope so.
I do. I hope so.
So there's a lot of, most of these cases, all of the cases we've talked about so far are young men, but there is one on the list that jumps out at it. You described it as one of the most mysterious cases you have ever investigated. Alyssa Lamb in Los Angeles.
Now, before I tell the audience about this case, what were your feelings about this case, George?
Well, it was weird. I mean, the stuff about the hotel jump out at me, which we haven't really touched on that, about particular locations where the things happen more than once. In the early going of this book, you mentioned a couple in Chicago where I got two cases from the same hotel, which just, you know, of all the hotels in Chicago, just seems kind of strange.
Towers. In this case, Lisa Lamb, 21-year-old student from the University of British Columbia. Unusual right there because there's a couple of cases out of UBC I write about in the book. January 31st, 2013, she travels from Vancouver down to Los Angeles. First of all, I'll talk about the location before I talk about her. This all happened at the Cecil Hotel, 640 South Main Street in L.A. It opened its doors in either 1924 or 1927, differing opinions there. 14 floors. There's four water tanks on a platform on the roof. There's restricted access to the roof. It's alarmed. They advertise the location as for business people. It's in an area that's now considered kind of a skid row. The residents of this place are interesting.
Yeah, that's to say the least.
Night stalker Richard Ramirez lived there. He's convicted of 13 killings from 84 and 85. He lived on the 14th floor for $14 a night. Some called the satanic killings. In 91, Austrian Jack Untwieger came to the U.S. and lived at the Cecil. He supposedly promoted himself as a journalist covering crime in L.A. He lived in the hotel for 5 weeks, killed three prostitutes in his room. In 64, a woman named Goldie Osgood was staying in the hotel. She was stabbed, raped, and died in the hotel. In the 50s to the 60s, the Cecil got notoriety as a location for the most suicides of any hotel anywhere. And there was in 54, a woman named Helen Gurney jumped, killed herself. In 62, Julie Moore jumped out the 8th floor, killed herself. October 62, Pauline Otten jumped out and landed on a pedestrian, killed both. At this point in the book, I said, now, would you like to know the history of a hotel before you booked a room in it?
Yeah, I mean, it made me think of The Shining. So, yeah, I'd like to know.
Yeah, and then I think now after I read about this, I thought, how many rooms have I stayed in where there's been a crime that's occurred in it, and I never even knew. So Lisa was a psychology student at UBC on holiday break. Her family owned a Chinese restaurant in Burnaby. She rode Amtrak to L.A., got a room at the Cecil, and according to her Facebook post, she went to the San Diego Zoo, went to Conan O'Brien's show. Friend stated that she never, ever would drink alcohol or smoke or take drugs. She called her parents daily until January 31st, 2013. Parents knew right away something was wrong when she didn't call. They called Vancouver PD, who called LAPD. LAPD brought out search dogs and scoured the hotel from the bottom floor to the top floor. And the dogs were taken to the roof and they found no scent of her anywhere. Nothing was suspicious. On February 14th, LAPD released a CCTV video of Alisa on the elevator. And you can Google this right now and see it. It's an unbelievable footage of Alisa wearing black shorts, red sweatshirt, sandals. She enters the elevator, presses the buttons, and she kind of backs herself into a corner, and she looks frightened. Some people say she's talking. She peeks outside the elevator, goes in and out, presses the buttons, trying to get the elevator to work. It doesn't. She goes in and out a few times, finally gives up, walks outside, gets out of view, and the elevator door closes. Never seen again. On February 19th, a resident in the hotel complained of low water pressure. The maintenance man took a ladder to the roof, unlocked the access door to the roof, turned off the alarm to the roof, and made his way to 4,000-gallon tanks that sit on this platform about 5 feet up off the roof. And these four tanks sit on a platform. Each tank's about 4 foot in diameter, 8 feet tall, with slick sides to them. He puts the ladder up next to one of the tanks, opens the latch on the top of the tank, looks inside, and sees Alisa floating face up and naked. He gets down, calls LAPD robbery homicide detectives, and they respond out. They're baffled by what they see, but they figure out that the tank opening is too small to remove her body. They cut a larger hole into the top of the tank, and they see her clothes and sandals around her in the tank. The coroner responds, removes the body, no visible injuries. On February 20th, 2013, CBC is the major news organization in Canada, and they schedule an interview with robbery homicide detectives. At the 11th hour, right before it's ready to go, LA cancels and never gives another interview about this. Nobody would talk about it. On February 22nd, a coroner's report came out and stated the cause of death was inconclusive. And for 4 months, there's nothing. On June 20th, the coroner stated the cause of death was accidental drowning, accidental death. They didn't test for certain substances in the body. They found her blood alcohol content at 0.02. But when the body decomposes itself, blood alcohol will show up, and that was the reason for that. I said, okay, I'm going to try to find out more about this. So I filed and got a 27-page coroner's report on this case. Now, she was wearing the same clothing that she was wearing in the elevator. The coroner's report said it wasn't suicide and no foul play was incurred. Think about these words as I read them. No foul play, no suicide. They said death was accidental. You got to follow the logic here. So you must believe that Alisa went to the roof, got in the tank somehow without a ladder. She wasn't under the influence of drugs. No drugs were found. Does this make any sense to you at this point?
I'm trying to remember, how did she get into the tank anyway? You said that the opening was so small. I mean, how do they propose she even got in?
They don't propose anything. There were no ladders on the roof, and you had to have a ladder to get up the slick side. How she got in, that's a million-dollar question.
I remember the footage because a lot of TV stations around the country played it, including ours. It just was so weird. It was like something out of a horror movie or something. Just weird.
Now, it gets weirder. Now, as I'm doing the follow-up on this case and I'm checking for articles around that date, I find an article about tuberculosis in L.A. So Alisa was pulled from the water cistern on February 19, 2013. On February 21st, there's an article in the L.A. Times, and it says CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is dispatching scientists to Los Angeles to understand a horrible and bad strain of tuberculosis spreading so rapidly in the L.A. area that they're trying to understand how it occurred.
On that note, Dave, I'm sorry to stop you right there when it was getting good, but we'll pick that up on the other side, and you'll continue the conversation about this very, very strange case, and then we'll be opening up the phone lines. Johnny Cash takes us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. A tale of angst, desire, passion, and pain. We've all been there. Bruce Springsteen, I'm on Fire, from the Born to Run album. We're talking with Dave Politis, whose new book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence, I think might be his best. Of all the Missing 411 books, might be his best. You can find it on his website. The connection there is on the Coast to Coast AM website if you're interested in getting your own copy. The case we were just talking about, Elisa Lam, this lady, this strange stuff that happened to her in this hotel in L.A., you know, we all, maybe you saw the video. I remember seeing it, and it was something like right out of a horror movie. That memory is not just a coincidence. There is a connection sort of to a horror movie, and it is a connection to a lot more. The case that is already pretty weird is about to get stranger. We'll hear the conclusion of that one, then open up the phone lines with your questions. Remember, we want your A game here for Dave Politis. Much more to come in our final hour of Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Dave Politis. Dave, back to the Elisa Lam case. Now, this hotel where she was staying, a lot of really weird stuff had happened there. A lot of bad things, a lot of bad people had been there. The circumstances surrounding her death are really weird. She ends up in this water tank. It's not really clear how she got in it, but it gets even stranger. Pick up the tale.
So one of the things that I should have take a step back and cover is the coroner's report. One of the oddest things in that report was that the coroner stated that they couldn't get blood tox screening on it because they couldn't find enough blood in her body to do the toxicological screening. And in the hundreds and hundreds of reports I've read, I've never read that. So that, to me, was one of the most unusual points about the coroner's report. I made a request to get LAPD Homicide's report on the incident, and LAPD said they won't release it. And I find that kind of unusual since they said it was an accidental death and drowning. Why wouldn't you release that?
Were there any, in the coroner's report, were there any puncture wounds or wounds that would explain that the blood could have got out of her body? Was there any blood in the water?
None and none. None were noted. There was no physical injury except a small scratch on her knee that was seen on the body, and that was it.
Just like it's evaporated.
Exactly.
The tuberculosis connection.
Yeah, so a couple days after she disappears, CDC sends some people out for a rapidly developing tuberculosis problem and a severe strain of it, not a normal strain. So Elisa Lam arrives in L.A. on January 26, 2013. February 19th, she's found in the tank. February 21st, an outbreak of TB like they've never seen happen. CDC sends a team out for it. Now, the part that's completely unbelievable is that when you look at the article, it says that they're going to use what's called the Lam/Elisa test to test the tuberculosis and the strain of it on the victims in L.A. I read it. I couldn't believe it. Not the Elisa Lam disappears. They're saying they're going to use the Lam/Elisa test. And when you look it up online, it exists. And it's existed for a long time. And how it got that name wasn't really clear, but it's been around for almost 8 or 9 years. So is that a coincidence?
That's a heck of a coincidence. And then there's the part about the movie, the movies.
So there's something called floating water. And one website drew me to this, and they talked about Elisa being in the water and being in the tank. Well, this movie's called Dark Water, and it was adapted from a Japanese movie by the same name written by a guy named Koji Suzuki. And it was about a 5-year-old girl who lives in an apartment complex with her parents. It's a run-down apartment complex. And one day they go to the roof to light off fireworks, and they discover a Hello Kitty bag on the roof. And during the movie, the daughter talks to an invisible friend while she's in the bathtub. And the elevators, she talks about moving on their own during the movie. So Elisa's found in a water tank. It's about a girl who talks to invisible friends in the bathtub. They go to the roof and they discover this. They live in a rundown apartment. The similarities were unreal. Now, what about the Asian victim in both incidents? Elisa's missing just as a TB breaks out in the city. Canines can't pick up her scent on the roof. She's found naked without her clothes and shoes. Interestingly, the cell phone that she carried with her everywhere was never found. She's a college student. The similarities between the other disappearances are there, and you can't ignore them.
You make a point in the book, in this chapter, where you say, look, you have to have an open mind if you're going to investigate these kind of cases. You got to look at a lot of different kind of sources of information. And you mentioned Chris O'Brien, his book, Stalking the Herd, which had a really weird case involving livestock, where a bunch of livestock end up, strangely enough, in a water tank. It reminds me, and I'll let you give some more details on that, but it reminds me of a case that we investigated at the Utah Ranch in the Skinwalker book, in that they had these four huge bulls, each weighing more than 2,000 pounds, that were in a corral. The rancher and his wife drive to town. They remark, boy, we'd be in trouble if something happens to one of our bulls. They come back to the ranch a half hour later, and all the bulls are gone. And they're searching high and low for them, can't find them anywhere. Inside the corral, there's a metal trailer, and there's only one door into it, and it's locked. It's latched with this really thick wire. The wire is still on. It's the only way to get in. He peeks into a grate, the rancher, and he sees the four bulls all crammed inside this metal trailer. There is no way to get them in there. There is no way, especially with the only door that's in there that they wouldn't fit through anyway, is still locked. And it reminded me of the example that you raised here.
And again, I'm not one to just walk away from similarities, but when Chris O'Brien, who's a really good investigator, wrote a book called Stalking the Herd, and it's about cattle mutilations. And part of the book talks about, and I know this because I've met people that have investigated this, these are not animal predations. These are different. There's no blood found in the bodies, and it's not that the blood washed out and leaked out and ran all over the ground, and even if it did, you'd find blood in the organs. No, there's no blood in the body. It reminded me of Elisa Lam. And then Chris talks about this case where these bulls, there's no way for them to get into this water tank. And this rancher, he's looking around for them and hears them and looks inside, and they're inside the water tank. And there's absolutely no way for them to get in. So I'm not one to walk away, even as strange as it may seem, to walk away from a similarity. But in Chris's book, there were two. There was the loss and absence of blood in a lot of these cattle mutilations. Well, there was an absence of blood in Elisa's body. And again, nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to address it. And everyone wants to go to that place in your mind where you think, well, you know, maybe it just leaked out. No, it just...
Well, when you add in the video that so many people saw on television, and then the fact of that hotel and all the strange stuff that had happened there, I mean, that should almost be a book by itself. That is a really strange case. And I don't know what it's saying to us. Seems like almost somebody messing with our minds. It's a mind game of some sort.
I would agree.
Well, let's take a couple of calls, Dave. On the wild card line is Robert in Baltimore. Hi, Robert. You're on with Dave Politis. Hello. Is Robert there? Hello.
You don't know that the elephant is standing next to you. You seem to be hinting at it, but you're very much avoiding the issue that most of the people listening to the Coast to Coast AM have accepted the fact that UFOs are real and that there are extraterrestrial beings on Earth, and that Eisenhower did make a deal where abductions would be allowed, but his deal said that they had to bring them back alive. They weren't supposed to keep them and kill them. But from all the other things you've heard, you must know about all these things, one of them is that the ET extraterrestrials are doing genetic experiments. Most of the things you've talked about tonight are explainable if you take it in the light of all of the information that is available to the people who have been reading about it. For example, why are they taking the very bright people when they abduct? Well, the reason is because they're doing genetic manipulation of the human species, and they're looking for the genetic codes which will help to contribute to that. So that would be their reason for doing that. And the reason there isn't any blood in your abductions is the same thing as with the cattle. They take the blood out before they drop the body back. and with the gal being inside and the animals being inside a building that you can't get into, this is a tough one to accept about UFOs, but apparently they have an advanced technology where they can take people out of a car or out of a building, take them up to their spaceship on a beam, which just doesn't fit. I mean,
okay, Robert, we get the point. We got the point. Let's let Dave get into this.
So I live in this world, and I am one of these guys that wants to stay towards the facts. And I've heard everything Robert said. I've heard it 100 times before. And I don't minimize it because I keep an open mind on it. But there are several things he said there where if I put 100 people in the room that are listening to this show, 20 are going to say A, 20 are going to say B, 20 are going to say C, and they're going to say it with the same affirmation that Robert did. They're I've heard theories 8 to 10 times about what's causing this, and the people are 100% positive they're right. So I'm not going to say Robert's wrong, but I'm going to say that there's probably 10,000 people out there with differing opinions, and they're 100% right in their own mind.
Here's the thing, too, Dave, and I know you get this all the time. You get people mad at you. Well, why don't you say that those cases in the forest, it's Bigfoot doing it? Why don't you just admit that's what it is? You started as a Bigfoot guy. Why don't you admit it? The same thing with it sounds like alien abductions. The fact is, as you go through these cases that you outline in this book and the previous books, there are no reports of UFOs surrounding these disappearances. If somebody was saying, yeah, my Uncle Joe disappeared in the forest and there was a flying saucer at the time, you'd put that in there.
Exactly. And in fact, you hit on something, George. I'm glad you brought it up. When I first started writing these books, I was hammered by the UFO, by the Bigfoot community saying, why don't you just say it? You know it. You won't admit it. You know that Bigfoot's taking these people, and it's pretty obvious, and you just won't say it. I defy anybody out there to say that these cases aren't related that I'm writing about. And if they are related, then you can see the progression of the research as we're walking down this road. And as somebody told me just the other day, we've identified a couple of spokes in this wheel, U.S. Forests and Parks. Now we've identified this taking of college-age men and women and killing them in water. How many other spokes to the wheel do we have to understand to totally change the paradigm you may have on this right now? How many more are there going to be? So if I said on that first year or 2 years of research, oh, yeah, it's Bigfoot, there's no doubt, how big of an idiot would I look like right now when it's pretty obvious it's something unusual, but it's sure not Bigfoot?
And the same thing, yeah, you don't want to lock yourself into the position that it's UFOs or aliens because you don't know. I mean, in these cases, that you're giving great amount of detail with each one of them, but none of that detail from none of the witnesses has any aliens around or flying saucers or beams of light coming out of the sky. So it would be a mistake for you to lock into that kind of position when you just don't have enough information. It would be, it just would be bad as an investigator to do that.
I would agree.
And I know it makes people frustrated. They think, well, he knows, he's just not saying. But you don't really know.
And, George, between you and me and, you know, 10 other people I talk to regularly, I don't hear anybody coming up and saying, oh, it's obviously this. And I'm talking about somebody who really is grounded and has their hands into a lot of different fields like you do and some other people, and they aren't coming out and saying it.
Let's try our first-time caller list, Brad in Oregon. Hi, Brad. You're on Dave Politis.
Hi, guys. Great show. I was just wondering, Dave, have you heard anything more about the Kenny Beach investigation in southern Nevada, which hits close to George's and my area right down there?
Actually, I have talked about this, and it is an unusual case. I'm not quite 100% there if it's a match, but there's a lot of unusual things. For the people that don't know Kenny Beach, there's a YouTube video out there where he actually is talking about an incident where he goes out into the Nevada desert and he finds a cave, and he goes into the cave and there's some strange sensations that he feels. Well, he gets out of there and then he comes back and he's trying to find this cave again. Well, it turns out he disappears, and his cell phone's found on the ground. And there's a search of the area, and there's a search of a cave nearby, but they never found Kenny.
And that's where the case stands now?
As much as I know, yeah.
So, caller, did you have some additional information?
No, I don't, but, I mean, I'm just checking into it more and more.
Yeah, it's a good one. We'll keep our eye on it. Thank you. We're going to go to the wild card line, Jeff in Culver City. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, George and Mr. Politis. Yeah, that guy from Baltimore, he kind of stole my thunder. But Mr. Politis, you mentioned the death of an FBI agent who supposedly committed suicide, who was monitoring many of these abduction sites. Here in Los Angeles County, there was an FBI agent who was, quote-unquote, missing, then found dead a couple of years ago in the mountains near Burbank, California. Officially, it was said that he was suffering depression. Who knows for sure? But when you said that their job was just to monitor these abduction sites, the word monitor also means observe, record, examine, study, watch, and oversee. When George mentioned that some of the victims were out of breath, as if being elevated through the air, I immediately thought about alien abduction, too. My question is this, Mr. Politis, if the FBI is not monitoring these abductions to observe or scrutinize alien extraterrestrial activity, could they be possibly monitoring to see exactly what our own government may be testing out, or perhaps foreign government experimentation with these baffling abductions and deaths? And I'll take your answer off the air.
So one of the things I say in the book is that I don't think agents are going to come out and interview witnesses if they have a grasp and a handle on what's happening. They really are trying to understand. I don't think they know a whole lot more. I'm sure they know more, but not a whole lot more, because when you go out into the field at the front end of an investigation and you're interviewing witnesses who are at the scene, you want to get firsthand knowledge. And when these people are disappearing out of the bars quickly, no witnesses, they're gone, I think they're trying to understand, and they're probably asking some real interesting questions of these people. What was your mentality? How did you feel at this time? You know, were you awake the entire time? I'm sure they're asking all these questions, trying to get a handle on what's going on. And I'm sure that they have as much of an open mind on things as you and I do.
I'm glad they're on the case, but I just wish that once they get more information that they let it out, and I suspect that, as you do, that they will not. Yeah. Let's try East of the Rockies, Joanne in Long Island. Hi, Joanne. Good morning. You're on with Dave Politis.
Hi, good morning. The last time you were on Coast to Coast, I never miss a show, you said the four ways we can protect ourselves from this happening. You said never go to a national park alone. I think you said you always go with someone. Carry a tracking device, a cell phone, and a firearm. I don't personally, if they can mess with your minds, then I don't think those would help you. I just tell people that don't go to a national park. And Do you have another way of protecting yourself? And I agree with the other. This is a form of alien abduction, but I think Dan Quayle is more on. I believe this is demonic, but that's just my personal opinion.
Wait, what? Dan Quayle? What?
I believe these beings who are doing this, they're the same ones who are abducting, even though there's no UFOs. They're demonic. But I believe you'll always be stonewalled. This is classified above top secret. You won't get anything from the government about this, because they know about it, but they can't do anything about it.
Okay, Joanne, thank you. Dave, let's let Dave answer your first part of it. Is there other suggestions and ways to protect yourself?
No, and I still stand by that recommendation if you're going into the woods. When you're in a city, I'm completely baffled by the disappearances of these college kids, because they were with friends. They were we couldn't cover the cases, but there were so many times that you're in a bar and boom, you're gone. You're a businessman walking out of a hotel on the way to a conference. Boom, you're gone. How they're happening in the middle of a city without other people knowing, that's the million-dollar question.
Like, if they want you, they can get you. We're talking with Dave Politis about missing 411, a sobering coincidence. The Eagles take us into the break. It's a rousing rocker recorded live in 1972 during a European tour by Paul McCartney and Wings. The song is called Best Friend, as if you needed something to wake you up tonight, because this stuff we've been hearing is certainly keeping me awake. Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence is the newest book by Dave Politis. And as I told you earlier in the program, all those books in the series have been good. I think this is the best one. And I can imagine, as I read this, the meticulous research and work that went into describing each of these cases, how many thousands of hours Dave must have worked to put this stuff together, to stitch together this rich tapestry that has become the Missing 411 books. And it's an amazing accomplishment for one guy who's sort of blazing the trail. He could use some help, frankly. He could use some help out there from those of you who are listening who work for some of these government agencies, the U.S. Forest Service, the National Park Service, FBI, maybe some military guys who have some information about it. Because in the early 411 books, of course, we heard about military interest in some of the disappearances in the national forests. And there's people listening to this program right now that have some information that can help crack this thing open. And we hope you'll contact us. If not, write to Dave, email him, contact him through the information we have on the Coast to Coast website. Or if you are worried about that, you can contact me and I'll pass it along. But he could use some help. When we come back, we'll get to as many of your calls as we can right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the phone lines are full. We'll get to them in just a moment. Dave, before I forget, I want to give you a chance to talk about your film project, because we had mentioned it on the air, and a lot of our listeners, I think, are very interested in the status. What's going on?
Well, we finished the Kickstarter, and we hit about 157% of our number. It takes about 6 weeks sometimes for Kickstarter to get us the money. And we don't have it yet, but as soon as we do, we're going to be back on the road again filming. We're somewhere between 30 and 45% done with the film. We project being done probably sometime in December, and hopefully we can get it edited and completed in time to make spring and summer film festivals. But everybody out there that contributed, a huge, huge, huge thank you for all the support. And one thing I got to say here is that I get probably 100 emails a month about this, and I think it's important to be said. And George, you don't take admiration well, I know, but I got to tell you, George, that you have so many admirers out there for the quality of work you do and the way you conduct yourself on the radio. Everyone asked me, they said, if you know George, can you please tell him how much he's appreciated and what a great job he does? And I got to say, George, I appreciate what you did for us on the movie, what you do for me on the show, and I can tell you that there's thousands and thousands of listeners out there right now that appreciate you that much more.
Well, I appreciate that as well. And now we're going back to the phones. Johann in Switzerland. I don't think I've ever had a call from Switzerland. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, George. Hey, listen, I'm the head of the International Reptoid Resistance. I'm up in Switzerland at Wurttemberg Castle. And I'm studying this thing you're talking about tonight, and it's obviously cases of reptoids coming, phasing in and out, and phasing people in and out in order to put them through tanks and different things like that. They come to their victims by using the GPS on the phones. All the technology we've gotten for the last 50 years are all alien reptoid related. And I want to point out one other thing, that when the Greeks first started democracy, they were talking to demons, democracy. They were trying to talk to departed human souls as to how to create a better nation through their democracy. And the departed souls could figure that out. St. George killed a dragon, and that dragon was physical in the 15th century. That was a reptoid. And so we've all gotten real confused over the fact that reptoids are what we call devils and Nordic aliens are what we call...
Okay, Johann, I'm going to ask you to bring this back on around as a question for Dave.
Well, you know, how can you think that it's anything less than extremely high technology for somebody to go through a tank, not be able to get in there with their blood gone? This is something to do with aliens with advanced technology.
Okay, well, thanks. We're going to let Dave answer that. Thanks for the call. It does seem to be technology.
Absolutely, and I do think that there's some element of that that's true. And this goes right back to what I think it was Robert, the conversation earlier. People are that positive that they know exactly what's happening, and even though you may be real strong in your opinion, there's others out there that are thinking different.
Yeah. We got reptoids and demons in there. The what I did learn is that there's something called the International Reptoid Resistance. I didn't know that existed. Thanks for the call, Johann. Appreciate it. We're going to go to Linda on the wildcard line. She's in Bloomington, Illinois. Hi, Linda. There's a little cluster area around there.
I almost didn't turn you on tonight. I thought you was going to be nothing but aliens, and so I usually shut that off. Anyhow, have you, there's two questions here now. Have you ever had anybody over 40 years of old, 40 years of age and older abducted? That's one. And number two is, have you ever heard of the body farm?
Never heard of a body farm, and in my previous books, there's many, many, many people over 40 I've written about.
Okay, now.
A body farm is where they put bodies to see how they decompose, and police and coroners study them, right?
Yes, and is it possible they could take these people, put them on a private plane, fly them to the body farm? Because I think there's one in either Tennessee or Kentucky, someplace off in that area. Is it possible that they could be flying them there, laying them out to all the elements, because they have massive grounds, and they can lay them out there, and they decompose, and then people can study them. And when they're done, they pack them up and bring them back and drop them off. Do you think that could be possible?
I would encourage you to read the books and look at the evidence and come to your own conclusion, but I would say that's highly impossible, because you're ignoring the fact that the canines aren't picking up a scent. There's no tracks of multiple people leaving the area. The victims, when they are found, they have a lack of memory, which doesn't fit. They should never be found under those circumstances. I mean, I could just keep going on and on, but none of it would make any sense.
Thanks for the call, Linda. West of the Rockies, is Lewis in L.A.? Is he still there?
I am. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I'm from Los Angeles, and I was wanting to let you know that I've stayed at the Hotel Cecil prior to Ms. Lamb disappearing, and I know for a fact I had my own personal paranormal experiences there, and I know other people have had that also. I'm wondering if that hotel might be a portal to another dimension, and not only is paranormal activity happening, but also extraterrestrial activity could have been one of the reasons she was found in the tank, or also could have been paranormal, because I know that hotel was a hotbed in the early days for drugs and partying and all that, and that could have led to the opening of demons into that whole hotel.
Well, it's certainly weird, whatever it is, whether it's paranormal or alien or whatever it is, it's certainly not normal. And Dave, when you finish with a missing 411 mystery, maybe you need to write a book about that hotel, because it sounds like there's a lot of material there.
I think you're right.
We're going to go to Joseph. Is Joseph still there? Let's see. Joseph is in Bethany. Hi, Joseph, on the Wild Card Line.
Hi. Hi, George. Hi, Dave. I've read all the missing 411 books, except for the current one, but I do plan on getting that. But anyway, I have a couple quick questions for you, Dave. Any cases fitting your criteria out of the state of Delaware or Eastern Shore of Maryland? And then my second question is, a few years back, there was a case of an Asbury Seminary student who went missing in Montana. And he's actually, the seminary's in Kentucky, and I believe that he's an international student from South Korea. I'm a student of that seminary, so I was just curious if you had any updates, if you came across anything about that. I think I've heard that he was found, but I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, the seminary student was Asian. He disappeared in Glacier National Park. I wrote about it in my books. He was found at the bottom of a cliff dead.
What do you make of the whole religious connection, Dave?
It's something I don't ignore, for sure, and there's been other people that have stated, you know, you've got to pay attention to that. I agree, and I do, and I write about it when I see it. But also, I, as strongly as I think that there could be some religious affiliation, I also think there's something to this German thing.
And I don't remember you mentioning either of those in the analysis of the rural and cases in the National Forest. Did you look at those now? Are you going back to look at them through that prism?
Well, I did. I did mention the German association several times. In fact, there was right off the top of my head, there's a case out of northern Canada where a girl disappeared and everyone wrote her off as dead. And her family was German. She spoke German. It even talked about it in the articles. And she ends up being alive days later and tells a phenomenal story. And, yeah, I do talk about it in those.
What about the religious part?
You know, in those, it came up a couple times, but I don't specifically remember as many cases as I did this time.
Okay, let's try Joe in Kern County on the wild card line. Hi, Joe.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in the middle of a cluster of these disappearances. We're surrounded by national forest. We even have the German connection. But since 2003, there's been about 18 suicides in this town, supposedly. And there's been four or five people that have just disappeared, turned up about 30 to 90 days later dead. The last one, 120 feet from the cop station. Have you ever heard of that?
What's the town?
Fraser Park.
I haven't heard anything about that.
People disappear here in droves sometimes, but I mean, we find people hanging. We find people, and none of the people who have disappeared and been found 60 to 90 days later, there's any reason for them being dead. I'm sorry, I'm a bit nervous.
Yeah, I wish I could say I knew more about it, but I don't. And up to this point, I would say that suicides aren't playing a big role in what I'm looking at. But I would also say that that area that you live in around Gorman, Lebec, Grapevine, there's been some strange things that have happened there over the years.
Loads.
Probably more a little south towards Castaic. And we're talking about the area north of Los Angeles off I-5. Yes. That's the best I could do for you.
Joe, you should, when you come up across this stuff, if it's newspaper clippings or something, you should make a copy of them and send them to Dave. I'm sure he'd appreciate the input. Thank you for the call. Try east of the Rockies, Bill in Rockland County, New York. Hi, Bill.
Yes, gentlemen, I used to work for a rather famous investigating news show that's on Sunday nights. Most people would know it. It's on early Sunday nights. But I believe that part of what you're looking at is infection with water systems, and that the people that are missing may have been mind-controlled, or they are guinea pigs to see how their health is doing. I also live next to a guy named Kevin Gannon. I don't want to go too far into that, but I believe it's the same guy. And a lot of Americans don't know. I worked on that very famous news show that's on Sunday nights. A lot of coroners are plants. They're either FBI, CIA, or NSA. And they're there for a reason, to cover things like this up. But just recently in New York, we had a rash of Legionnaire's disease in water tanks. And what I believe we're looking at is a military intelligence program to infect the water systems at some point to cull back the population. Sounds extreme, but I wouldn't rule anything out here. If people think this is Martians and reptilians, okay, fine. I don't think so at all. I think what you're looking at is a military intelligence program. Those that are that suddenly feel tired, I believe that there's been a program, and if you use the thing called NORA, which is the Non-Related Observable Awareness Program, which I'm sure Mr. Politis is aware of, you could probably backtrack and find out who called them. And things were implanted in these people, and they want healthy young people to determine if the water systems in their area have been infected and how
okay.
that is.
All right. Thanks, Bill. We got the point. Dave, you want to comment on Bill's observations?
I suppose there could be some association with the urban disappearances, but many of these people weren't anywhere near a public water storage facility in the days before they disappeared. And I just happen to know many of their movements before. They were drinking things that came out of a bottle, not out of a tank. And if you believe that there's an association between the two types of disappearances, the people in the woods definitely had no association with a public tank. But I think it's interesting. I took notes on it.
And again, you know, looking at this from 30,000 feet as you do, it's just so weird overall. If you look at them case at a time, it maybe is not as obvious, but for so many people in urban areas that are covered with asphalt to end up drowning in these tiny little bits of water, the only water that's around that they're, where they could drown.
Exactly.
Let's see, Mike in Wolf Point, Montana, on the wild card line. Mike, we got about 2 minutes left.
Well, George, Dave, I just got a quick question. What are some of the more common attributes amongst the cases? I remember there were certain things about the parks, like the guy in the front of the line or the guy at the tail of the line, and usually end up missing, and people that walk with dogs usually end up gone. And so are there any commonalities amongst these urban missing people that kind of relate and say, yeah, that's definitely one of these cases, or is it just a hodgepodge of things that make it fall into that category?
Well, in each of the urban disappearances, in all of them, 100-plus in the book, there's never a witness to the person actually going into the water or the receptacle where they're found, ever. A lot of times people are seen jumping into lakes, rivers, creeks, and things. Never this time. The point that they're separated from people, that's never seen. And again, that's a commonality with urban or rural disappearances. That separation point is never observed.
And at a lot of these cases, you mentioned in the book, there's video cameras that probably should pick up something that don't.
Oh, and some of the cases I've written about in Chicago, there's a panning camera, and the camera pans and shows the person there on that location. It pans back. Seconds later, the person's gone.
Try to get one more quick call in. Roy on the first-time caller line in California. Hi, Roy. Better make it a quick one.
Hi. I just had maybe some information that might help with one of your cases. Can we go back to the guy that was...
We got a minute, Roy. We got a minute here, if you want to...
Okay. You had the guy that was on the antidepressants. You said he was taking disipramine and amitriptyline.
No, I never said he was taking them. I said that they found it in the system.
Okay, yeah, but what I'm saying is those were in his system, and you said he had alcohol in his system also. Those antidepressants are pretty dangerous, pretty sedative, and people have often used those for suicide attempts, and they should never be used with alcohol. And I'm wondering...
Okay. All right. I'm going to have to go, Roy. I appreciate it. That's a good point. But I think Dave has sort of already addressed that. You said it was just really unusual for that guy to have that in his system at all.
Absolutely. He wasn't a depressed individual, wouldn't take drugs. It makes no sense.
Thanks to all of our callers. Dave, I really like the book. It's good stuff. Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence. I recommend it to everyone. I can't thank you enough for being onto the program, for all the work you're doing.
Thanks a million, George. Appreciate your time.
Talk to you again soon. Thanks also to my colleagues there at Coast, Jeff DeRay, Ben Haley, Dan Galani, Chris Boros, our webmaster, Tim Binal. And tomorrow night, a Coast Insider Chat with Dr. Michael Sala, talking about exopolitics. Thanks to Ray Regal and my temporary home, KXNT. And, of course, thanks to my guest, Dave Politis. I'll be back next month. Good night, everyone.